Welcome back, everyone. Ready for another deep dive? This time, we're going back in time to explore early nationalist movements in India. We're talking about the period from 1857 to 1947, a period that really laid the groundwork for India's eventual independence.
It's a fascinating period, full of incredible stories of resistance, reform, and a growing sense of national identity.
And what's really interesting is that we're not just relying on typical history books for this deep dive. We've got colonial records, accounts of the East India Company's activities, and even glimpses into how architecture and the arts reflected this changing landscape.
It's remarkable how these different sources can paint such a vivid picture of the times.
Right. So let's start with the East India Company. Now, most people think of them purely as a trading powerhouse, but their influence went way beyond just buying and selling. Right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they basically became administrators, imposing systems like the Zamindar land revenue system in Bengal.
The Zamindar system. That sounds familiar, but can you remind us how it worked?
Yeah,
sure. Basically, the British appointed local landlords, called Zamindars, to collect taxes from farmers and then pass those taxes on to the British government. It was supposed to streamline the revenue collection process and create stability.
Sounds simple enough, but I have a feeling it wasn't that straightforward.
You're right. The Zamindar system actually ended up disrupting traditional land ownership structures, leading to a lot of resentment among Indian farmers. It was one of those cases where a system designed to bring order actually created more chaos.
Ah, so that's where we start to see those early seeds of discontent, those sparks of resistance against British rule.
Exactly. People weren't just going to sit back and accept these changes without a fight.
So who are some of the key figures in this early resistance? Were there any individuals who really stood out?
Well, you have figures like Banda Bahadur, a Sikh leader who led a revolt against Mughal rule in the early 18th century.
So even before British dominance really took hold, there's already the spirit of resistance brewing.
Oh, absolutely. India has a long and complex history of resistance against various forms of authority. And the Sikhs, with their emphasis on social justice and self-reliance, were often at the forefront of these struggles.
That's fascinating. It seems like the Sikh community played a really significant role in shaping the political landscape of the time.
They did. And their influence only grew as the East India Company's power expanded throughout the 18th and 19th centuries.
Okay, so we've got these early sparks of resistance. But how did things evolve as we move into the 19th century? Did these isolated acts of rebellion start to transform into a more organized movement?
Well, that's where we see the rise of reform movements and organizations dedicated to promoting Indian interests. For example, there was the Triplicane Literary Society in Madras.
The Triplicane Literary Society. Tell me more about that.
Well, it was one of many groups that started springing up around this time, advocating for things like social reform, education, and greater political representation for Indians. And then there was the Indian Association in Calcutta.
So these organizations were kind of laying the groundwork for a more unified national identity, bringing people together from different regions to address common concerns.
Precisely. And that's where the Indian National Congress, or INC, enters the picture. It was initially formed as a platform for educated Indians to voice their concerns to the British government.
So the INC was like the voice of the people, trying to advocate for their interests within the existing system. But I'm guessing it didn't stay that way for long.
No, you're right. The INC gradually evolved into a much more powerful force, advocating for greater autonomy and eventually complete independence from British rule.
Okay, so the INC becomes this key player in the independence movement. But were things always smooth sailing within the organization itself? I mean, we're talking about a massive country with a lot of diversity. There must have been some internal disagreements about the best way to achieve independence.
Oh, absolutely. There were constant debates within the INC. Some members, known as the moderates, favored a more gradual approach. They wanted to work within the system, pushing for reforms and greater representation over time.
A more cautious approach. What about the others?
Well, the others, sometimes called the extremists or radicals, wanted more assertive action. They believed in complete independence and were willing to take a more confrontational stance against the British.
So you've got this tension between those who want to play the long game and those who want to push for immediate change. It sounds like it must have been incredibly difficult to present a united front.
It definitely added another layer of complexity to the struggle for independence.
And remember, we're talking about India, an incredibly diverse country with a vast array of cultures, languages, and religions. Trying to unite such a diverse population under a single banner of nationalism must have been a monumental task.
Oh, without a doubt. It was a challenge from the very beginning. And this is where we start to see how the cultural and intellectual landscape of India played a crucial role in shaping the independence movement.
Okay, so we're talking about a shift from purely political action to something deeper, something that speaks people's hearts and minds.
Exactly. Think of powerful imagery like Bharat Mata, which means Mother India. This symbol really captured the collective imagination and helped foster a sense of shared identity among Indians.
Mother India as a symbol of the nation. That's powerful.
It resonated deeply with people who were longing for freedom and self-determination. It wasn't just about politics. It was about reclaiming their cultural heritage and asserting their right to govern themselves.
And it wasn't just about symbols either, right? Literature played a key role in this cultural awakening as well.
You're absolutely right. Writers like Bankim Chandra Chatterjee used historical fiction to rekindle pride in India's past and inspire a sense of national unity. However, it's important to note that these narratives sometimes came at the expense of portraying Muslim rulers negatively.
So even within the movement for independence, there were these underlying tensions and complexities. It wasn't simply a case of Indians versus the British. Different groups within India were also grappling with their own identities and aspirations.
It's a good reminder that history is rarely simple or straightforward.
No, it definitely isn't. And this complexity only intensified as we move into the early 20th century, with the rise of communalism adding yet another layer of challenge to the struggle for independence. But I think we should probably save that for the next part of our deep dive.
Sound like a plan. You know, it's fascinating how even as this movement for independence gains momentum, we start to see these internal divisions emerge that really complicate the narrative.
Right. It's like they're fighting this external battle against British rule. But at the same time, there's this internal struggle over what a free India would actually look like.
Exactly. And one of the key players in this internal struggle was the Hindu Mahasabha.
The Hindu Mahasabha. Okay, remind me who they were again.
Well, they were an organization that advocated specifically for Hindu interests, often pushing the idea that Hindus should have a dominant role in an independent India.
So while the INC was trying to build this broad coalition for independence, the Hindu Mahasabha was promoting a more exclusive vision.
Precisely. And this idea of Hindu majority rule really gained traction among certain segments of society, and it created this real fault line within the broader nationalist movement.
It's almost ironic, right? Fighting for freedom from colonial rule, but potentially replicating some of those same power imbalances within their own society.
It highlights the complexities of nation building, especially in a country as diverse as India, where you have all these different religious and cultural groups with their own histories and aspirations.
Of course, we can't forget about the British role in all of this.
Yeah.
They weren't exactly innocent bystanders, were they?
Not at all. The British were masters of the divide and rule strategy. They knew how to exploit existing tensions between different communities to maintain their own control.
So they actually exacerbated the situation, making it even harder for Indians to present a united front.
Absolutely. And this brings us to a really pivotal moment, the Cripps Mission of 1942.
Oh, yeah. The Cripps Mission, wasn't that supposed to be like this attempt to appease the Indians and kind of get them on board with the British war effort?
In a way, yes, it was meant to offer India dominion status after the war, but it ended up failing pretty spectacularly.
Why did it fail? I mean, was it just that the British weren't sincere in their offer?
Well, there was definitely skepticism about British intentions, but the proposals also didn't go far enough to satisfy the INC, who wanted immediate control of the government, including the defense ministry.
So even if the British had been totally genuine in their offer, it sounds like the INC was ready for full independence and nothing less.
That's right. And even within the INC, there were disagreements about how to respond to the Cripps mission. Gandhi, for example, was deeply distrustful of the British, and he famously called the offer a post-dated check on a failing bank.
Wow. A post-dated check on a failing bank. That's a pretty powerful image.
It is, and it reflects the deep distrust that many Indians felt towards the British at that point.
So Gandhi's rejection of the Cripps mission must have further alienated the Muslim League, who were already feeling marginalized within the INC.
It did. The Muslim League, led by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, saw the failure of the Cripps mission as further proof that their interests couldn't be guaranteed in a unified India, especially one dominated by Hindus.
And this is where Jinnah's vision for a separate Muslim state starts to gain real momentum.
Right? Exactly. His articulation of the two-nation theory, the idea that Hindus and Muslims were two distinct nations, became increasingly popular during this period.
And tragically, this ultimately led to the partition of India in 1947.
Yes, one of the most tumultuous and heartbreaking events of the 20th century.
Millions of people were displaced. Countless lives were lost. And the legacy of partition continues to shape the relationship between India and Pakistan to this day.
It's a sobering reminder of the devastating consequences that can result when political ambitions and unresolved differences are allowed to fester.
But even amidst this tragedy, it's important to acknowledge the incredible resilience of the Indian people and their unwavering commitment to freedom.
Absolutely. And to remember that the story doesn't end with partitionality. India faced a whole host of challenges, many of which stemmed from the very issues we've been discussing.
Like the challenge of creating a truly unified nation out of such incredible diversity.
And the challenge of overcoming the legacy of colonialism and building a more just and equitable society for all Indians.
Wow, it's amazing to think about everything we've covered, you know, from those early acts of resistance to complex internal struggles and the ultimate triumph, but also the tragedy of independence and partition.
It really makes you realize that history is so much more than just dates and events.
Yeah, it's about understanding the forces that shape societies, the choices people make, the unintended consequences. You know, it's a complex tapestry.
It really is, and I think one of the key takeaways from this deep dive into early nationalist movements in India is the power of collective action.
Right, we saw how those early protests against things like the Zamindar system eventually grew into this massive movement for change.
Exactly, and it's inspiring to see how people from all these different backgrounds and regions could come together united by this shared desire for self-determination.
Yeah, it's a testament to the human spirit.
But it's also important to acknowledge that this unity was often fragile.
Oh, definitely. You know, we talked about the rise of communalism and the Hindu Mahasabha's emphasis on Hindu dominance. Those were real challenges to building a truly inclusive movement.
Right. It shows that even in the fight for freedom, there can be disagreements about what that freedom should look like and who gets to benefit.
And it makes you think about the importance of leadership that can bridge those divides and find common ground.
Absolutely. Leadership that can create a shared vision that encompasses all those diverse perspectives.
And we also saw how crucial that cultural transformation was in shaping the independence movement.
Oh, yeah. Those powerful symbols like Bharat Mata and the literature of Bankim Chandra Chatterjee really helped to galvanize this sense of shared identity and national pride.
It's fascinating how ideas and narratives can have such a profound impact on people. Mm-hmm. You know, they can inspire, mobilize, and unite, but they can also divide and exclude.
And that's why it's so important to be critical of the narratives that were presented with, you know, question assumptions and seek out multiple perspectives.
Absolutely. It's about being an active participant in understanding history and not just passively accepting a single version of events.
Exactly. And speaking of questioning assumptions, it's also crucial to acknowledge the lasting impact of British colonialism on India.
Right. We focus a lot on resistance in this deep dive.
Yeah.
But we can't forget that British policies and institutions often had a profound and enduring influence on India's social, economic, and political structures.
Yeah, the Zamindar system is a perfect example. It was designed to benefit the British, but it had all these ripple effects on Indian society.
Disrupting traditional land ownership patterns, contributing to rural unrest, even after independence.
Exactly. It's a reminder that these historical events can have long-lasting consequences that we're still grappling with today.
So as we wrap up this incredible journey, what's the one thought you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the story of India's struggle for independence is a story of both triumph and tragedy. It's a story of incredible resilience and courage, but also of division and loss. And it's a story that I think offers valuable lessons for all of us about the nature of social change, the power of ideas, and the importance of inclusive leadership in navigating a world of diverse perspectives.
Beautifully said. It's been an amazing deep dive, and I hope our listeners are inspired to continue exploring this fascinating period in history on their own. There's always more to learn, more connections to make, and more insights to uncover.
And most importantly, I hope it encourages them to reflect on how these historical events can inform our understanding of the present and maybe even inspire us to build a better future.
Because ultimately, history isn't just about the past. It's about who we are and where we're going. And that's something worth thinking about.
I couldn't agree more.